I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which recently lowered tuition by 30% and guarantees graduation in 4 years to all students who meet certain criteria. Carthage ranks 15th in best value among Midwest regional colleges, according to U.S. News and World Report. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu. It's always a great pleasure when we can explore the legacy of William Shakespeare. And it is always a special pleasure when we can, in a sense, dig beneath the surface and explore some of the mysteries that surround Shakespeare. And in particular, some of the questions which have dogged the legacy of Shakespeare for hundreds of years, namely, who exactly is responsible for the plays we attribute to William Shakespeare? Did he write them? Did he write them on his own? Were they inspired by others? Is there even the possibility that there are people who are largely responsible for at least some of his greatest works? The book that we're going to be talking about today explores the tireless explorations of one Dennis McCarthy, who has explored such a possibility, and that is the possibility of someone, in a sense, lurking behind the scenes with a large amount of responsibility for what we think of as solely Shakespeare's works. And Michael Blanding's book is called North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. That subtitle refers to a scholar by the name of Dennis McCarthy, and we maybe put the term scholar in quotation marks because he is himself quite a controversial figure and does not come to this with necessarily the standard credentials, but he has been tireless in his efforts to explore this intriguing question of the possibility of a certain figure from close to Shakespeare's time being at least somewhat responsible for the plays of Shakespeare, one Thomas North. So there is the central crux of this fascinating new book called North by Shakespeare, published by Hachette. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with the author of this book, Michael Blanding, who's already given the world a couple of fascinating books before this, The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps, and The Coke Machine, the dirty truth behind the world's favorite soft drink. Again, this new book called North by Shakespeare. Michael Blanding, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here and talk about the book.
This sometimes is a bit of a mundane question. Once in a while I skip it, but I sure don't want to skip it in this case. How did you first find out the story of Dennis McCarthy and Dennis McCarthy's great curiosity about one Thomas North. When did this story first cross your path?
Yeah, that's a bit of a story in and of itself. I was giving a talk for my last book in 2015, so about 6 years ago. And Dennis approached me afterwards, and we got to talking, and it turned out that he had written about maps as well, and so we had that in common, and he invited me out for drinks, and after a couple of drinks, he laid the story on me and said that he'd been sort of obsessively researching the source of Shakespeare's plays for the last decade, and that he thought that they were based on the work of this earlier writer, Sir Thomas North. And at the time, I had only kind of vaguely been aware of these conspiracy theories about Shakespeare and about someone else writing the plays, and I really didn't believe any of it. I sort of humored him, and I said, sure, send me what you got, and I'll take a look at it. And he started sending me just document after document with just this really compelling evidence about this possibility that Shakespeare borrowed from the works of this other really fascinating, amazing figure. And that kind of started me on this path where eventually we traveled through Europe together and had conversation after conversation. And I did some of my own research and really came to believe that there was something there.
Interesting. It's interesting the connotation of the term conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorist. And I think for most of us, it's not a very positive connotation. I mean, it is somebody who not only sees a shooter on every grassy knoll in Dallas, but who sees sort of sinister workings behind every closed door. I mean, obviously, there are conspiracy theorists who are not operating in the realm of reality or fact or science. And I suspect, the way you described this first meeting with Dennis McCarthy, that you probably shared some of those misgivings right off the bat.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that, I sort of use the term literally because a lot of people do believe that there was a conspiracy back in Elizabethan times and that another writer like Sir Francis Bacon or the Earl of Oxford really wrote the plays, and it was sort of this, closely held secret by a number of people. And what I came to find about McCarthy's theory that I found really interesting is that he believes that that Sir Thomas North didn't actually write the plays, but that he wrote these earlier source plays that Shakespeare then took and adapted, almost like, Peter Jackson adapting J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or something like that. And so Shakespeare could actually put his name on these legitimately. And at least by the standards of the time, they could be seen as Shakespeare's work. So there was no conspiracy needed for this theory. And it made a lot of sense that there have always been these questions about how Shakespeare could have the knowledge of traveling in Italy or fighting as a soldier in war, all of these things that are so brilliantly depicted in the plays, and yet we find no evidence of it in Shakespeare's biography, and yet Thomas North's biography is sort of chock full of this information. So it became a very intriguing possibility.
Right. Well, in the subtitle of the book, you term Dennis McCarthy a rogue scholar. So it's probably important for us to explore that question and maybe also explore what I said at the outset. I think I called him a scholar with quotes around the word scholar. and maybe that's being unfair to him. But I think you yourself have called him a self-taught scholar. And there are plenty of people who would say, that's something else. That's not a real scholar. When a real scholar teaches themselves everything they know, there's a little bit missing from the equation. But that also maybe is an unfair assumption. Tell us more about Dennis McCarthy and why he deserves to be called not just a scholar, but a rogue scholar.
Yeah, he is really a fascinating character. I mean, as a subject, he becomes as much a part of the book as Sir Thomas North or William Shakespeare, because he actually is not trained as a scholar, not trained as a Shakespearean. In fact, he barely graduated high school and dropped out of college. But he's one of these people that's just incredibly smart. And when they apply themselves to something, they just go all in and can uncover and learn things about it that maybe people who are more traditionally trained don't see. And he did this first with science and started studying this field called biogeography, which looks at kind of how plants and animals move around the world. And he actually ended up publishing these academic papers in journals and even wrote a book about the subject that was really well received by people. And then about 15 years ago, he turned to the subject of Shakespeare and originally was sort of interested in Shakespeare's stories and looking how these stories kind of moved around the world from writers to writers. And that's how he sort of stumbled on Sir Thomas North as this missing link in Shakespeare's plays. And since then, he has, you know, just dove in. And, you know, his techniques are really interesting because a lot of them revolve around using computers in interesting ways to analyze the plays. And they're techniques that have been used by other scholars. But I think he comes at it with a real open mind and without a lot of the baggage that maybe some classically trained Shakespeareans have who sort of, you know, deify William Shakespeare as this sort of lone genius. And so it's caused him to be able to look at it in a new way and say, yes, Shakespeare may have been this genius adapter of these other plays, but that indeed he was not solely responsible.
When you describe this first encounter with Dennis McCarthy in your book, I remember you saying to the effect that as he was kind of spinning all of this out for you, you struggled to follow his argument. But at some point, you, in a sense, became a believer, or if not a believer, there was something about what he was saying to you, even if you didn't understand each and every bit of it, that was compelling to you, and led you to believe that there might be something there. Aside from just kind of the mountain of supposed evidence that he had assembled, what else was it about the argument or the case he was putting to you that was so convincing?
Yeah, well, I try to maintain my skepticism as a journalist throughout the book and really present the evidence and let the reader decide. But, you know, I have to say, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't think that there was really something there. And how much of what McCarthy claims is true, again, I'll leave that up to the reader. But, you know, what he's able to do is, first of all, use this computer software to find all of these phrases that were in Thomas North's printed and unprinted work that has shown up in Shakespeare in really, really interesting and surprising ways. You know, he literally has thousands of these phrases and hundreds of passages that have been lifted from Thomas North into Shakespeare. But beyond that, he's also been, for each play, been able to trace elements of Thomas North's life that he's found and, you know, various references and allusions to what was happening in Elizabethan history at the time that would have interested North. And he's able to do this for each and every play for 50 years. And when you start looking at just that math and that accumulation of evidence and then have to kind of wrap your head around the number of coincidences that would have to be true in order for that to just be happenstance, it becomes harder and harder to believe that there wasn't something there. And so ultimately, yeah, if not convinced, I definitely was compelled and persuaded by a lot of his work and really think it could change the way we read the plays.
We're speaking with Michael Blanding about his new book, North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. It is an examination of this possibility that one Thomas North deserves at least some credit for the plays that we think of as being solely by William Shakespeare, the contention of one Dennis McCarthy. And Michael Blanding in this book not only explores that central question, but also writes about Dennis McCarthy's tireless exploration of this very possibility. One of the really beautiful passages in your book, among many, is towards the very beginning, in which you describe a certain majestic scene in 1575. And it's a really intriguing example of what you were talking about earlier in terms of elements that show up in Shakespeare's play that would seem to have been inspired by events that he very likely did not or even could not have witnessed himself. Explain to our listeners the scene that I am talking about that you spell out in your book so beautifully, and the way in which that connects to this central question of where Shakespeare's plays came from.
Yeah, this was this amazing party that took place in 1575 that's called the Kenilworth Festival. And I really enjoyed kind of diving into exploring this moment in history in which this man named Robert Dudley, who was the Earl of Leicester, was trying to woo Queen Elizabeth, and he pulled out all the stops in this amazing party that lasted for 19 days, and there were, you know, 40 bottles of wine a day that people were swilling, and these elaborate entertainments involving, you know, people dressed up in these fairy costumes and these, all these sort of mechanical devices rigged on this man-made lake with, you know, a mermaid and people dressed up as Greek gods. I mean, it was really the premier entertainment of the time. And scholars have long identified a passage in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream as being inspired by the Kenilworth Festival. And yet they have no idea how Shakespeare could have witnessed this, because he was only 10 years old at the time, and he wouldn't sort of have had the credentials, you know, to as a commoner to get up close and see these entertainments. And yet we know that Sir Thomas More's brother was the best friend of the Earl of Leicester, and he attended the Kenilworth Festival. And while there's not a record of Thomas More attending, it's very likely that he went with his brother. And so, you know, it's one of these sort of uncanny connections to Thomas More's life and one of the plays that you know, really tie them together and raise this intriguing possibility that he may have actually witnessed these entertainments and then worked them into this scene in A Midsummer Night's Dream that's lasted throughout the ages.
Hmm. Tell us more about Thomas North, his life, and in particular his legacy as a writer.
Yeah, so Thomas North is best known as a translator of other works. And his best-known translation is called Plutarch's Lives, and it's a series of biographies about Greek and Roman personages. And it's been very well established that this book is the source for Shakespeare's Roman plays, Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus. And in fact, there's whole passages from Plutarch's Lives that are basically lifted into these Roman plays, almost verbatim. You know, maybe Shakespeare changes them from prose into poetry, but you know, a lot of the wording is the same. And, you know, it's notable because it's really the only source that Shakespeare ever used like that. Every other source, he would rewrite it, and he would make it his own, and he would change it, and it's only these plays by Roman plays in which he's using Plutarch's Lives that he follows it so closely. But McCarthy believes actually that those are not the only plays that Shakespeare used Thomas North as a source, and that North wrote a number of other plays himself that Shakespeare used, and for many other works in the canon, including Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet and King Lear, you name it. And as I said before, you know, North led this amazing life where he fought in war, he served as a diplomat to France, he traveled to Italy on this delegation to the Pope, and so he really had all of these amazing experiences that could have somehow made their way into the plays and then been adapted by Shakespeare many years later.
One of the intriguing questions, evidently, is that Dennis McCarthy seems to believe that Sir Thomas North himself wrote plays that would have been that direct link into the plays of Shakespeare, but we do not know of the actual existence of any such plays. I mean, is there even the mention of Sir Thomas North actually writing plays himself?
There are some clues that McCarthy has identified that seem to point to Thomas North as a playwright, but you're right. The actual plays that he is speculating that Shakespeare adapted do not exist. And that has been a real sticking point, as you can imagine, for a lot of the scholars who have criticized and even attacked McCarthy, where they're saying, you know, you're basically making up these plays that don't exist, and what grounds do you have to do that? And McCarthy's response is that actually most of the plays from the Elizabethan period have been lost. We only have like 10% of the plays that we know were written at the time. And there's only maybe another 10% where we even know their names or something about their plot. But in terms of actual source plays that Shakespeare adapted, we do know that Shakespeare often used other plays, and there are specific plays that have specific names and as I say, elements of their plot that are even spelled out in historical documents that people speculate Shakespeare used as plays that he adapted. And so what McCarthy's really doing is just saying that all of those source plays that scholars have identified were all written by the same person, and that's Thomas North. And that is certainly controversial, and it certainly causes people to raise their head and decry McCarthy's work, but it's not as radical as it may first seem.
Right. In other words, when we first hear about this, we immediately think of terms like plagiarism and plagiarism mm-hmm. as we think of that term. And that term simply does not apply here, or does not apply in the way that we customarily use that term in 2021.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, the word plagiarism doesn't even enter the English language until 1598, which is well into Shakespeare's career and almost at the end of Thomas North's life. And, you know, at the time, it was really common practice for writers to take other works and rewrite them and rework them and make them their own and put their name on it. And it was a very established sort of practice that you had all of these plays with sort of similar names or certain similar plots that people were passing off as their own. But at the same time, there were a number of other writers who sort of pointed to Shakespeare. There's satirical pamphlets that still exist where they were actually accusing Shakespeare of sort of lifting material from other writers, and they weren't too happy about it. And they called him an upstart crow and said that, you know, he beautified himself with the feathers of other writers. So even back then, there were some questions about how original Shakespeare's plays actually were. But a lot of that's gotten lost as we've sort of, you know, held Shakespeare up as sort of the be-all and end-all of Elizabethan drama.
Back to Dennis McCarthy for a moment. Most of the conspiracy theorists that I know, and I've known a couple, tend to really live and be sustained by what gets commonly called confirmation bias. That is, by glomming onto every bit of information that confirms what they believe to be true or want to be true, and conveniently bypassing any evidence to the contrary. I'm just curious, would Dennis McCarthy be guilty of that? And as you were kind of following him, if indeed you kind of witnessed that, was part of your role to try to keep him as honest as possible in his pursuit of this question? Or were you more of an observer, not wanting to be a part of it to that extent?
Yeah, it's certainly a good question. And, you know, what I will say about Dennis is that he is incredibly obsessive. I mean, he has to be to have followed this for 15 years, you know, especially in the face of all the rejection that he's received from mainstream academia. But, you know, I tried as a journalist to really question him and really raise other possibilities, and I include a lot of that in the book as well. There's some things that he puts out there that I found, you know, a little hard to swallow, and I call him on that in the book. But he seems very conscious of trying to avoid that kind of confirmation bias that you talk about. For example, when he uses this computer plagiarism software to compare Thomas North's work and Shakespeare's plays, he has also done this additional search, so he'll find these, you know, passages in the plays that have a number of phrases in common, and then he'll take those phrases and he'll go and he'll check them in databases that of basically all the literature from the period and say, you know, is this something that was just very common at the time? Was everybody kind of using these phrases, using these words, or was this really unique to Shakespeare and Thomas North? And in many cases, many, many cases, they're actually unique to Shakespeare and Thomas North, or they're very rare, and other writers weren't using them. So, you know, you see him struggling with that and trying to, you know, really question his own bias, which made it a lot more palatable to me when I started following him and questioning him, that he, you know, had sort of come from a scientific background. He's aware of this kind of tendency that scientists have to you know, see things the way they want to see them, let's say, and has actively tried to fight against it.
Is he unanimously rejected by the mainstream Shakespeare scholar community, or are there at least pockets of Shakespeare scholars of a more traditional stripe who find some of Dennis McCarthy's arguments compelling?
So he has had one scholar who has gone all in with him, and this is a woman by the name of June Schluter, who is a professor at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, and she was actually the former editor of a Shakespeare journal, so she really knows her Shakespeare. And he approached her about a paper that she had written years ago, and they had gotten to talking, and he started sharing evidence with her. And the more she looked at it, the more she really started to believe and to buy into his theories, and has really helped him kind of shape the theories and make them more palatable to an academic audience. And in fact, they've written books together. They have written about these two manuscripts that Dennis has found in the archives, and brought out the books with scholarly presses and published some academic papers on this together. And so she has really legitimized him in a way with some other scholars who, you know, maybe have sort of grudgingly accepted at least parts of Dennis's theories because he's had this this other scholar who has worked with him. But one of the things that I find really interesting is that oftentimes when McCarthy just puts out a part of his theory and says, you know, here's a manuscript I discovered that's a source for Shakespeare, then he'll get all this attention and excitement, and scholars will say, yes, you know, this is a really amazing find. And then as soon as he says, and I believe that it was used by Thomas North to write these source plays, they just shut the door and they say, you know, as soon as you start saying anything about someone else writing Shakespeare's plays, you know, they just don't want to listen. And I found that to be very, very intriguing, but also very, very unfair. And it was part of the reason I wanted to write the book.
A last question. This possibility that Thomas North is a figure behind the scenes in the construction of Shakespeare's plays, what does that do to you as you read Shakespeare now? Does that alter either the way you see these plays or the way you appreciate these plays or experience them? What kind of difference does that make for you, and should it make for the rest of us, if indeed this possibility of Thomas North proves to be true?
Yeah, it's a really great question, because you could say, you know, what does it matter who wrote the plays, whether it was Shakespeare or the Earl of Oxford or Thomas North? You know, the plays are the plays. They've stood the test for hundreds of years and you know, been performed and loved. And I think that that's true on the one hand. But on the other hand, when you start looking at the plays through the lens of Thomas North's life and work, it opens up whole new possibilities and a whole new richness through which we can experience the plays differently. You know, for example, Thomas North was really obsessed in many of his works with writing about kind of what it takes to make a good ruler. And when you read Shakespeare's plays, you know, they're so fascinated with this question. You know, not just the English histories, but in Hamlet and Macbeth and even As You Like It and The Tempest, it's all about sort of, you know, revolution against bad rulers or embracing good rulers. And so it kind of allows you to read some of those plays in different ways. And then the other thing is that, you know, there's elements of Thomas North's life that, you know, he really experienced some of these experiences that are reflected in the plays, whether it's Henry V and the fact that Thomas North went to war and you know, lived this sort of disastrous war in Ireland, and you can see that reflected in Henry V, or the fact that he was in poverty at one point when he was older, and you see, you know, King Lear, this impoverished king when he was older. And so when you start to read the plays and know some of the background of the person who may be responsible for writing it, it really allows you to reinterpret it and really allows you to, I think, kind of feel it more deeply than you otherwise would have. Hmm.
The book again is North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Works, published by Hachette, and the author, Michael Blanding. Michael Blanding, thank you so much for giving the world a really fascinating book. And thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I'm so happy to have had this chance to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been really fun to talk about it.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We are looking back a half century to passage of the Civil Rights Act, which transformed so much of America and the lives of so many Americans, but not without a long and difficult fight, and a complicated fight as well. And the struggle to pass this groundbreaking legislation is recounted in breathtaking detail in a brand new book called An Idea Whose Time Has Come, Two Presidents, Two Parties, and the Battle for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, written by Todd Purdom, and maybe you know his work as a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine, senior writer at Politico, and for long time, many years, a writer for the New York Times. This book is published by Henry Holt and Company, again titled An Idea Whose Time Has Come. Todd Purdom, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
So glad to be with you. Thank you.
I'm so grateful for this opportunity. The book is marvelous. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about the passage of 50 years and what it's like to look back over that particular span of time, where, of course, so many of the principal players are gone, but
yes,
not all of them. And this resides vividly in our collective memory and yet was a fair time ago. What has this been like for you as a historian to probe into this particular story?
Well, it was really a wonderful experience because, of course, Greg, this is the law that created modern America. In some ways, it created the world we live in today. And it's hard to remember that just 50 years ago, segregation was legal throughout so much of the country, and black Americans could not go into hotels and motels, restaurants, lunch counters, and the like. And it seems almost unimaginable when you look at Washington today and you see the man in the White House. For me, as a Washington reporter, it was also a wonderful experience to go back in time and to sort of relive the Washington of 1963 and 64, which I must say, for all its problems, was a much less depressing place than the Washington of 2013 and 2014. People actually managed to get something done, and that was quite inspiring.
Hmm. I think you do a beautiful job of setting the stage for the sort of high-profile events which occurred in 1963 and, of course, 1964. But there is a backdrop there that's important for us to understand. And at the heart of it is the first of the two presidents involved here, of course, President Kennedy, and the sort of conflicted views that he had, not only about civil rights, but what he should do about civil rights. Tell us how President Kennedy really came from one place to another place when it came to this crucial issue.
Well, yes. I mean, he personally was always appalled by discrimination. He thought it was wrong. I don't think he had a racist bone in his body, but he also didn't really know any black people outside of his own valets. He did not know black professionals except those in the civil rights movement itself. So while he campaigned in 1960 on a strong civil rights platform, and Richard Nixon did the same, I should say, when he got into office, President Kennedy was very reluctant to put civil rights front and center because he feared it would alienate the Southern Democrats in Congress whose support he needed for the rest of his legislative program, including a major tax cut that he was trying to push through as an economic stimulus. So he was very careful and he took his time. But by the spring of 1963, he'd lived through a whole series of tumultuous events, the Freedom Rides of 1961, the integration of Old Miss, which turned into a riot in 1962, and then, of course, famously, Birmingham in the spring of 63, when those police dogs and fire hoses of Bull Connor were turned on young people and demonstrators peacefully asking for their rights, knocked to the ground by high-pressure hoses. That appalled the president. It appalled the world. And that's what finally galvanized political attention in Washington to propose a bill.
You've just touched on something as you described that scenario, the fact that both President Kennedy and his challenger, then Vice President Richard Nixon, both had civil rights planks in their platform, so to speak. In fact, you tell us the 1960 Republican and Democratic platform planks on civil rights had been virtually identical.
Yes.
And equally strong, if still mostly unacted on 3 years later. And of course, that's a hard thing for us to sort of wrap our heads around, given sort of a different alignment of the political parties today. Tell us how the matter of civil rights broke down, Democrat versus Republican, back in the early 1960s.
Well, at that point in time, the Republican Party still took seriously its legacy as the party of Lincoln. And after all, it had been founded as a political party to oppose slavery. So to the degree that civil rights was a national political issue at all, for much of the 20th century, it had really been a Republican issue. And because of the divisions in the Southern side, with the huge opposition in the Senate and in the House, Republican support was absolutely crucial in passing the bill. And on a proportional basis, the Republicans provided more support for its passage. In the Senate, 27 of 33 Republicans voted for the bill, which again is, seems almost unimaginable given today's party alignment, because in a real way in the past 50 years, the parties have simply flipped. There are still Southern Democrats. They're just called Republicans now.
Hmm. One of the interesting backstories, and this is even ahead of the actual drafting of proposed legislation, which ultimately in a revised form, of course, finally passed 50 years ago. One of the most interesting sort of backstories is the relationship that you describe between President Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. and the fact that for all the ways in which they admired each other and perhaps understood each other, there were some drastic differences in personality that made, in a sense, a working relationship and cooperation between them very, very tricky. Describe what was so complicated and maybe the most vexing differences between Kennedy and King.
Yes, well, their mutual advisors say that they never really could warm up to each other as personalities. President Kennedy was detached, ironic, sort of perpetually bemused by the world. And Dr. King, of course, was very serious, earnest, somewhat stuffy at times. And President Kennedy thought he took himself awfully seriously. There was another thing at work, which was that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover were filling the president full of innuendo about Dr. King's alleged ties to people who had been supporting the American Communist Party. And indeed, one of his crucial advisors, Stanley Levison, had at one point been a fundraiser for the Communist Party. But what Director Hoover never told the president is by the time this bill was under consideration, Levison had long since ceased any support for the Communist Party. But the problem from Kennedy's perspective was, if he was seen as being too closely associated with Martin Luther King, who was still a very controversial figure in many quarters, he felt it might undermine his own credibility. And certainly, if Dr. King was seen as having communist associations, he felt it could jeopardize the Kennedy administration's political standing very seriously. So it was a fraught relationship, and as you say, there was mutual respect at the end of the March on Washington when Dr. King came to the White House with other leaders. President Kennedy reached out and said, "I have a dream." But it was not a warm and close personal relationship by any means.
I think you quote someone named Harris Wilford saying, "There was always a strain in his dealings with King, who came on with a moral tone that was not Kennedy's style and made him uncomfortable." And King, by the same token, viewed President Kennedy as lacking moral passion on this issue. And, of course, that ultimately would begin to change.
Yes, I think that's true. And interestingly enough, later on, King did seem to have a better rapport, for a time at least, with Lyndon Johnson, a fellow sort of Southerner. They had some kind of body language that was more compatible. But then, sadly, by the time Dr. King was killed in 1968, his opposition to the Vietnam War had made it such that he and President Johnson really weren't even on speaking terms anymore.
Mm. One of the most interesting confrontations which you describe, which I think is worth talking about, because in a sense it really embodies the sort of impasse that we're talking about here, was when Attorney General Robert Kennedy was testifying on Capitol Hill before the Judiciary Committee with Sam Ervin of North Carolina,
yeah,
grilling him mercilessly. And of course, many people remember Sam Ervin for very different hearings a decade later, would be probably astounded at the kind of things that Sam Ervin had to say back in 1962, 63 about this proposed civil rights legislation. And a comment at some point is made about the two of them scarcely speaking the same language. Tell us just about this confrontation and how it, in a sense, embodies what this whole struggle was about.
Well, Senator Ervin was torturing the Attorney General on all kinds of picayune points of law, and he was trying to elicit from him, you know, Senator Ervin wanted to know about why do we have a written constitution, and Kennedy had to answer because we want to protect the rights of individual people against the actions of the state. And so from Senator Ervin's point of view, the idea that the administration would invoke the Commerce Clause of the Constitution to say that discrimination should be forbidden because people went from hotel to motel, from state to state, and that this was, you know, illegitimate behavior. Senator Ervin, you know, was trying to contrast that with part of the argument that's still often made today about private property rights and the sanctity of every man's castle and the business owner's right to refuse service to anyone. At one point, Ethel Kennedy ran into Ervin at a White House party and said, "What have you been doing to Bobby? He came home last night and went straight to bed." And as you say, there was a wonderful exchange in which Kennedy said, "We're not speaking the same language." And Ervin said, "Well, we're both speaking English." And Kennedy said, "Yes, Senator, but that's as far as it gets."
Hmm. Of course, the struggle for passage of a civil rights law changes completely with the assassination of President Kennedy in November of 1963. And a new president, Lyndon Johnson, I suppose in some ways quite unexpectedly, takes this up as the first of his priorities at that tumultuous moment in our history. And he had to stare down people he had known and were good friends for many, many years. Tell us what this struggle represented to President Johnson and the way in which it was both a confirmation of who he had always been and also a departure from what at least some of his legacy had been up to that time.
Yes, because for part of his early career in Congress, he had never been a violent segregationist, but he had certainly voted against federal civil rights laws for much of his early time in Congress. As he evolved and had national political ambitions, and also as his own thinking and experience evolved on the question, he had become quietly, actually, a very strong supporter of the idea of civil rights. And he was pushing President Kennedy harder and faster than President Kennedy wanted to be pushed in the spring of 1963. So by the time he takes office, he really decides that the only way he can establish his credibility as president is to get this issue resolved very quickly, to make it a memorial to President Kennedy, to show the public and the world that he's willing to pass an even stronger law than maybe President Kennedy could have got on the books. And he wants to do this because he thinks he'll need that power and credibility to get the other laws he wants, what later became the Great Society, Medicare, Medicaid, those social programs that were so dear to his heart. But in the process, he does have to tell his old mentor, Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, whom he regarded as a kind of father figure, that, you know, "Get out of my way. I'm going to run over you, and I'm not going to compromise." And Senator Russell said, "Well, you may do that, but if you do, you'll lose the South for a generation for the Democratic Party. And you may well lose the 1964 election." And Johnson plunged ahead all the same.
The opposition to this bill from people like Mr. Russell, how much of that opposition was based on what we think of as classic racism, bigotry, versus a devotion to a way of life and a sense of order that they simply were not willing to or were too frightened to relinquish?
I think it's a complicated question. There was certainly some overt and unrepentant racism, and certainly people, Senator Russell's on record as saying, "You may say, a white man, that you're no better than a black man, but I don't have very much respect for you if that's what you think." But there were also a lot of people who simply felt that this was an intrusion on private property rights, that this might create a kind of government bureaucracy that would be a big brother mentality. There was a civil liberties argument to it that, in fact, persists to this day. Remember, in the 2012 campaign, Rand Paul, running for the Senate in Kentucky, allowed us how that he wasn't sure the Civil Rights Act was constitutional because it interfered with private property rights. So there was a mixture of overt racism and what you correctly would call kind of cultural fear of change. And I think, to his credit, Senator Russell himself did recognize the times were changing. He knew he was fighting a losing battle. And to his very great credit, when the bill was passed, he was the first to say that it's the law of the land and we must obey it. He did not call for disobedience or anything like that. And in some ways, I think that all stands in sharp contrast to the reaction to the Affordable Care Act and the willingness of so many governors or Republican members of Congress to try to undo it or defy it. There was not that opposition to the Civil Rights Act, in part because it passed with such overwhelming bipartisan support.
Right. Many of us know, of course, the kind of tactics that President Johnson used. Many of us know at least something of what Robert Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey did. Who would be one or two of the sort of hidden heroes in this battle to win passage of this Civil Rights Act that you are glad to be able to highlight for us in your wonderful
book?
Well,
one of my favorites is a congressman from West Central Ohio named William McCulloch. His hometown of Piqua is actually represented today by Speaker John Boehner. He was a rock-ribbed conservative, opposed to federal aid to education, opposed to gun control. We'd think of him as a very comfortable modern conservative. But he was a strong supporter of civil rights. And in the summer of 1963, after President Kennedy proposed the bill, he told the administration that he, if they made a promise not to water it down in the Senate, which had been the usual practice, and to give the Republicans equal credit, he would bring along his Republican caucus in the House to support the bill. And at the end of the day, that's just what happened. And his pledge also forced first the Kennedys, then the Johnson administration, to do something that had never before been done successfully, and that was break a filibuster in the Senate on civil rights. So he's almost a forgotten figure today, but when he was retiring from Congress, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis wrote him a moving letter from Aristotle Onassis's yacht in Greece, saying that she knew and President Kennedy knew that he was perhaps more responsible than any other single person for the passage of these laws. And he's been a figure somewhat lost to history, and I'm glad to have a chance to remind people of just what he did.
Well, and of course, in your book, you outline for us the rich, complicated story of how this very important legislation ultimately saw the light of day and ultimately was passed, an idea whose time has come, published by Henry Holt & Company. Todd Burdum, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Andrew Dogan, who is with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, talking about the group's upcoming concert in early May. On Thursday, we are hoping to bring to you a conversation that had to be postponed from last week with Amy Hart and Sonia Hill, who are with the Walworth County Health and Human Services Department, talking about a new program there which should allow mental health specialists to come along with police officers for certain crisis situations where their help might be tremendously beneficial. On Friday, Claudia Kalb, author of an intriguing book called Spark, The Arc of Genius. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which recently lowered tuition by 30% and guarantees graduation in 4 years to all students who meet certain criteria. Carthage ranks 15th in best value among Midwest regional colleges, according to U.S. News and World Report. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.